I would like to say that I was shocked, but at this point, I've learned to accept that this survey reveals very, very high rates of violence.
A new survey reveals high rates of sexual assault in the Mat-Su Valley. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Wednesday, October 9th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Alaska's Chief Justice talks about why diversity on the court is necessary.
Public trust and confidence is incredibly important in ensuring that people comply with the court's orders.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips. The easy oil is gone, and getting to the remaining oil will be a challenge that will require the state and the industry to work together. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company.
And by
Northern Air Cargo. Since 1956, Alaskans have entrusted Northern Air Cargo to transport their freight. Thank you, Alaska, for the opportunity to serve you for decades to come.
There are certain rules of decorum you need to follow if you're going to an assembly meeting. You need to sign up if you want to speak. You need to keep your comments short. And you need to put away all sporting gear, as Anchorage Assembly Chair Ernie Hall reminded the audience last night.
I'm going to ask that all of the individuals that have brought tennis rackets this evening during the break to please have those removed.
The place looked like a tennis training camp because the assembly was deciding whether to use state funding to build a new indoor tennis facility. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reports that $10 million earmark has become a lightning rod issue because the city didn't ask for it, and many lawmakers thought the money was being used for other purposes.
If there's one thing everyone at the meeting could agree on, it's this.
Tennis is an incredible game that builds character.
It is a fun game.
Tennis is my favorite sport.
Tennis keeps people active, it cuts down on obesity, and there are lots of benefits to having tennis courts that can be used year-round by anyone, no matter what their income level. Dislike of tennis is not why the Anchorage Assembly is considering rejecting a state grant to build indoor courts near the Dempsey Anderson Ice Arena. Instead, it's a question of process, says Assemblymember Bill Starr.
Well, it wasn't transparent enough, and it also wasn't assembly directed.
Every legislative session, communities across Alaska hand over wish lists for capital projects. The Anchorage Assembly didn't have anything about indoor tennis courts in their request. The ask was instead made by Mayor Dan Sullivan, by the Alaska Tennis Association, and by the community council in the area. Starr's other problem with the funding is this. If you look at the state capital budget, the money was put in with a line that reads Project 80's deferred and critical maintenance. Most of that funding is going toward repairs to older city buildings like the skating rink. Starr thinks that legislators got hoodwinked into approving a project that went beyond renovations.
And I also believe that some of the folks in Juneau, that's what they thought they were approving. And so when you see that it's divergent into a brand new $10 million standalone facility, That's a challenge point for me.
Mayor Sullivan doesn't think it should be. He says rejecting the money on the basis of process would be punitive to the tennis players and community members who want the project to go ahead.
It's a minor point. It's a technicality, and it's kind of irrelevant, quite frankly, because the bottom line is the legislature intended for the Tennis Association to get money for a facility.
So who's right? Did the legislature want the money to go toward tennis courts or not? I emailed all 60 legislators to see if they knew where the money was going when they voted on the capital budget. Of the 20 who got back to me before deadline, one said he knew there was money for tennis courts in the budget, but he didn't know the assembly wasn't on board. The rest said they had no idea it was in there. Because capital budgets are expected to shrink over the next few years with a major tax cut on oil and declining production, the appropriation elicited harsh words from some. Senator Liesl McGuire, an Anchorage Republican who is running against Mayor Sullivan in the lieutenant governor's race, takes special issue with the funding. "The whole thing stinks," she wrote in an email. But the members of the public who came out for the assembly meeting said the project should go through anyway. Nearly 50 people testified, and almost all of them were tennis players who said that Anchorage would benefit from having a public tennis facility that people could use in the wintertime without having to take on an expensive gym membership. The Alaska Club's owner, Robert Brewster, was one of the few who opposed the project. As an owner of private tennis courts, he argued that the cost of the project doesn't match the demand for indoor tennis. In the end, the Anchorage Assembly decided to put the issue on hold. They'll revisit the funding question in 2 weeks. I'm Alexander Gutierrez with help from Daisha Eden.
Almost half of the adult women in the Matanuska-Susitna borough have experienced some form of sexual violence at least once during their lifetime. That's the sad news to come out of a recent survey conducted by the UAA Justice Center and the Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer reports.
Dr. Andre Rose is director of the UAA Justice Center. He says Alaska Victimization Survey interviewers contacted close to 1,200 women by phone for the survey earlier this year. The results did not surprise him.
Even though we found that more than half of adult women had experienced violence, we know that the estimates are conservative, and unfortunately they're consistent with what we've seen in other surveys. I would like to say that I was shocked, but at this point, I've learned to accept that this survey reveals very, very high rates of violence.
In the past year, more than 2,000 adult women in the Matsu have experienced intimate partner violence, getting hit, slapped, burned, or hit with a fist or a heavy object. Almost a third of Matsu adult women had suffered a forcible sexual assault at some point in their lifetime. During the past year, more than two women a day in the Matsu experienced forcible sexual assault. And Rose says the survey numbers are probably just the tip of the iceberg. He says homeless women who were excluded from the survey have likely had multiple sexual assault experiences. He says the survey numbers are not linked to the population growth of the Matsu.
The survey only looked at how many women had experienced violence. It did not try to delve deeper into why that violence occurred.
The Council on Domestic Violence and Sexual Assault is a state council within the Department of Public Safety, established in the 1980s to fund shelters, rape crisis centers, and other programs, and to coordinate state response to these types of issues. Lori Morton, executive director of the CDVSA, says the survey is part of a national effort developed by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention in 2009.
Our goal is to make sure that if a community wants the information, we can get it and make it available to them. And for the state, we hope it's going to be a way to measure effective strategies and public awareness campaigns that we have instituted since the governor's Choose Respect initiative.
Rose says the half-hour phone survey covered what he describes as very graphic questions. He said survey interviewers knew how to determine if the subject of the interview was in danger or not.
The interviewers are very highly trained, and they're able to detect when an interview should be stopped. And so by the time we ask those very sensitive questions, they have established a very good relationship with the interviewee, and they are able to determine whether this is a safe time to proceed with the interview or whether we should stop it or reschedule it if necessary.
The goal of the survey, Rose says, is to establish a solid baseline for the Matsu borough. He says the Justice Center is hoping to see the borough examine the results and assess its efforts at preventing sexual violence. Morton says some programs are already in place to educate girls about sexual violence. The fourth R is a high school curriculum for high school boys and girls to learn about healthy relationships.
There's a running program for girls age 8 to 13 called Girls on the Run that will be coming to the Matsu this year, and that pairs young girls with adult women in physical exercise and also information about how to make good choices, how to be assertive, how to know what you want and ask for that.
Surveys conducted in other parts of Alaska had similarly high numbers. Rose says he hoped that researchers would find some regions with a lower rate of sexual violence, but that was not the case. The results of 10 surveys statewide have already been published. Two more are to be published soon. Those are for the Kenai Peninsula Borough and Ketchikan. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, artists prepare to build a massive sculpture in Fairbanks.
I want to, when I'm 90 years old, when I come up to Fairbanks, to be able to go by and go, yep, I made that, you know, and it's still beautiful.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by BP, supporting public broadcasting in Alaska, and by Enroll Alaska, helping educate and enroll Alaskans in health insurance under the federal mandate created by the Affordable Care Act. Learn more at enrollingalaska.com.
The Alaska Supreme Court was in Barrow last week to hear a climate change lawsuit on the Barrow High School stage. Chief Justice Dana Fabe says it's important for students to learn how their legal system works. The Chief Justice feels strongly that diversity on the bench helps communities have faith in the decisions judges make. In her chambers at the Boney Courthouse in downtown Anchorage, she spoke highly of her predecessor, Jay Rabinowitz, who believed all Alaskans should have equal access to the judicial system.
I love being in his chambers. Whenever I'm puzzled about something, I think that the answers must be in the walls somewhere.
When you came here 37 years ago, 1976,
yes.
What were your thoughts and aspirations? Did you imagine yourself in this office someday, or what did you think about this?
Oh, absolutely not. I came after law school for the clerkship with the Alaska Supreme Court thinking it would be a wonderful way to learn more about the law and improve my research and writing skills and work with a very exciting court, and I thought it would be an adventure for a year, and here I am over 37 and a half years later.
In that time, in nearly four decades, what have been some of the big changes that you've seen in how the Supreme Court does its business?
Well, certainly there's a larger body of law that we have of our own to draw on, a larger body of precedent. When I was first up on this floor as a law clerk, the Alaska reporters took just a tiny portion of one shelf, and as you can see over above my desk, I have several shelves of case books. And we certainly still do see cases of first impression, issues that the Alaska Supreme Court hasn't decided before, but not as many perhaps as the court did in 1976. Certainly there's more diversity on the court in that not only was I the first woman appointed to the court, but Justice Morgan Christen was the second woman appointed to the court, who served with me for over 2 years, I think almost 3 years, before she went on to become the first woman from Alaska appointed to the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, the federal appellate court.
Last week you were in Barrow. Seems like logistically that's got to be quite an undertaking to get all the justices up to a remote community. Barrow is not as remote as many communities, but still, logistically, it must take quite a bit to schedule it all. Why is it important to do that?
The reason it's important is putting this program on a high school stage allowed the students of Barrow High to see the arguments live. But before we put on those arguments, we had volunteer attorneys, the district attorney, the public defender, private counsel in the community all went out to the high schools to teach the case, and we prepared some materials out of our offices for the local attorneys to educate the students about what the arguments entailed, what types of arguments had been raised. They created a workbook of materials for the teachers to have so that everybody came into the argument very well prepared, and the students then were, after watching the argument on the high school stage, were able to ask questions of the lawyers who presented the arguments while we were backstage and couldn't hear those questions. We were in the soundproof booth, and they could ask the lawyers, why did you argue this, or did you think that argument resonated with the court, or whatever they wanted to ask. And then we came back out in our street clothes, out of our robes, and answered questions about how we became interested in legal careers and any other questions the students wanted to ask about us or the legal system or the justice system that didn't involve the case.
You have spoken in the past about the need to have courts reflect the communities that they serve. What can be done to better ensure that that's happening?
Public trust and confidence is incredibly important in ensuring that people comply with the court's orders. And part of having confidence in the fair and impartial adjudication of cases is
having confidence that the judiciary reflects the community and that there's the same diversity in the judiciary that we have in the community. It's not that you have women and men or people of different backgrounds applying the law any differently. The rule of law means that you have a rule that you take and you apply to the particular facts in the case. However, I think each of us comes to the bench with our own lens of experience, and I think to the extent that we can look at a bench as a whole and see many different types of backgrounds and experience reflected, that's a good thing, and I think it leads to public trust and confidence in the system.
Chief Justice Dana Fabe speaking to us in her chambers at the Alaska Supreme Court. Pictures are at our website, alaskapublic.org. The owner of Niblack Mining Project on Prince of Wales Island continues to explore the possibility of a minerals processing plant on Gravina Island near Ketchikan. KTOO's Casey Kelly reports.
The Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority and Heatherdale Resources Limited on Tuesday announced a memorandum of understanding for evaluation of a mill and tailings facility at the Gravina Island Industrial Complex. ADA is a state-owned corporation set up to advance economic development in Alaska. Spokesman Karsten Rodvik says the agreement will help it investigate financing options in support of the Niblack project.
Part of the feasibility that they're doing, of course, is to determine whether or not they'd be able to process materials in state or if they would have to process them out of state. That's where we come in. We look at the Gravina Island Industrial Complex site as a potential site for Niblack to process the materials.
Financing could be key for moving the project beyond the exploration phase and into permitting. Niblack project manager Graham Neal told an audience at the recent annual meeting of Southeast Conference that Heatherdale has had trouble attracting enough investors.
As an exploration company, we are at the whim of the financial markets, and we are, you know, the only way we can raise money is by investor dollars. And for whatever reason, over the last couple of years, I'm sure people's portfolios have noticed that, you know, investment dollars have kind of dried up, and they're just getting harder to come by. So in 2013, unfortunately, we just couldn't raise the capital that we needed to pull off a program.
The Canadian company has long expressed interest in the Gravina Island site for a minerals processing plant. Last year, it agreed to a memorandum of understanding with the Ketchikan Gateway Borough, which owns the industrial complex land. If developed, it's estimated Niblack would create up to 230 full-time jobs at both the mine site and the processing plant. Heatherdale is the sole owner of the copper, gold, zinc, and silver prospect, located about 30 air miles southwest of Ketchikan. Geologists say Niblack's mineral deposits are similar to the Greens Creek mine near Juneau. In Juneau, I'm Casey Kelly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Alaska Business Monthly Magazine, publishing statewide news on Alaska's business sector, government, and industry since 1985. Information and subscriptions online at akbizmag.com. Thousands of Alaskans have already gone through a home or commercial energy audit. These programs can identify ways to save a third on energy costs. For more energy and cost-saving tips, visit akenergyefficiency.org. This message sponsored by the Alaska Energy Authority.
Southeast Alaska's maritime economy provides more than a quarter of the wages paid in the region. That's according to a new study published by the Southeast Conference. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld reports.
Good morning, hello, and welcome to Alaska's newest and best shipbuilding facility.
That's Frank Foti, president and CEO of Vigor Industrial. The Portland-headquartered company owns Alaska Ship and Dry Dock in Ketchikan. There, he shared the stage with officials last spring to celebrate the opening of a new ship construction hall.
After the collapse of the timber economy here, these leaders saw an opportunity for growth and jobs and economic prosperity, while others saw only derelict infrastructure and a dying industry.
A new study shows the Ketchikan shipyard is a key contributor to the region, with about 120 employees and $37 million in annual revenues.
So who are we?
What sets us apart from other places and makes our region unique? Is there one thing that defines our people, our geography, and our economy?
Melanie Shivens researched that question as part of Juneau-based Scheinberg Associates. She spoke at last month's Southeast Conference annual meeting in Sitka, where the study was released.
We are here today to tell you that there is. We are a maritime economy and a maritime region.
That's no surprise, given Southeast's geography, but the study has the details to prove it. The report shows about 400 maritime businesses and government agencies employing more than 8,000 people. Their total annual wages come to about $500 million, with individual wages averaging about $50,000 a year. Researcher Barb Scheinberg says this is the first thorough study of what she calls the blue economy. It includes commercial fisheries, ferries, and marinas.
When you think about the visitor industry, that includes whale watching cruise staff. When you think about construction, that's our marine welders. When you think about government, that's our Coast Guard folks.
Not included were onshore businesses relying on cruise ship passenger traffic or barged goods. She says ocean harvests dominate the maritime economy.
And that's our seafood processors and commercial fishermen, the mariculture workers. That's where half of the maritime jobs and wages are.
Scheinberg says the blue economy is larger than mining, timber, construction, or any other sector in Southeast. Shiven says shipbuilding and repair jobs have doubled over the past 5 years.
This growth is not accidental, but resulted from strategic planning and targeted investment.
Like Ketchikan, Wrangell is a former logging town that's found new opportunities. State and federal grants, as well as private investments, have paid for seafood plant improvements, a marine service center, a travel lift, and a new harbor. Economic Development Director Carol Rushmore says that's brought unexpected benefits.
Now we have transient moored space. So now we're seeing yachts coming to Wrangell because before we never had that ability. Commercial fleets were being rafted 3 or 4 feet deep. Well, the yachts don't want to tie up to the commercial boats. But now we're seeing this huge increase in yachters coming to Wrangell. And it's added an extra element to our tourism industry.
She says it hasn't been easy. Grants take years. Community planning can be contentious. And it's natural for people to become impatient.
Recovery is very slow, as you all are very painfully aware of as well. It has taken 20 years for our community to start rebounding.
Wrangell isn't all the way there. It still hopes to see development at the sites of its old mill and a former Bureau of Indian Affairs school. Rushmore says that could include more expansion of the city's blue economy. This is Ed Schoenfeld reporting in Sitka.
A pair of Canadian sculptors selected to build a piece for downtown Fairbanks visited the community last week to preview officials and the public about the project. As KUAC's Dan Bross reports, their work is designed to represent and reflect the local environment.
Vancouver-based metal and glass artists Cheryl Hamilton and Michael Vandermeer have been commissioned to build a piece for the new green space between the Cushman Street and Illinois Street bridges across the Chena River.
Mike's from the north. I've spent a lot of time in northern Canada, and we both focused on sort of the same things that we think, you know, are present here in Fairbanks.
Yeah, there's something about the north that has such a stark beauty, and we wanted to try to capture that.
The sculpture they're building is called Polaris. It's a collection of stainless steel spires up to 36 feet tall that'll jut from the ground at angles and reflect light of varying colors projected onto their mirror-like surfaces.
We drew inspiration from the Northern Lights, from minerals. We wanted something that had presence. We couldn't come up here and put a flimsy sculpture. It had to be masculine and macho and big, and so we wanted to somehow capture that harshness, and yet it's still really beautiful.
The sculpture design was selected through a long request for proposal process administered by a Fairbanks Metropolitan Area Transportation System committee as part of the Illinois Street Reconstruction Project. The process was initiated after an earlier, more generic state-selected sculpture was rejected by the public. Mark Fayish, who served on the Art Selection Committee, says, like much of the world, Fairbanks has a problem deciding what art is.
And public art, if anything, is only making it, gets it in everyone's face. And that's good and bad.
So you think that through that process we were able to kind of do a consensus?
You know, the easy answer, sure. But, you know, the truth is, whether it gets accepted or not will become apparent over time.
Fayish describes the selection process completed last year as filled with acrimony.
So we had 90 choices, and to get it down was a real trick. But I think we did fine, and we're standing behind it.
The selected sculptors are veterans of several large public art projects and know what they're up against.
It has to be something that we feel proud of when we bring it to Fairbanks, right? So,
yeah, we love sculpture, and we're totally committed as sculptors, so I want to, when I'm 90 years old, when I come up to Fairbanks, to be able to go by and go, yep, I made that, you know, and it's still beautiful.
Hamilton and Vandermeer anticipate it'll take 1,000 hours of welding and a serious amount of grinding and polishing to finish the spires.
We're thinking about 3,000 hours. Yeah, I mean, yeah. We're going to be sore. I mean, I'm going to have giant shoulders by then.
Yeah, we'll both look like Popeye.
The duo say there are no shortcuts, but the result of all the handwork is well worth it.
What we like about it so much is that it's like giant jewelry. You know, if you get it bright and shiny, it's just so pretty.
That finish, though, is going to be what makes that sculpture timeless, and it's going to carry that sculpture forward for, you know, long after we're gone, that sculpture will still be shining. So that's the beauty of, you know, putting the labor into it.
Vandermeer and Hamilton don't expect to get rich. The contract for the Fairbanks sculpture is $300,000, but they say the purchase of high-grade stainless steel from the Lower 48 and the outsourced cost of cutting and bending the metal in Seattle doesn't leave much for big paychecks. The sculpture will be shipped in pieces to Fairbanks next summer and put up over a few days in August. In Fairbanks, I'm Dan Bross.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org, and you can follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Ellen Lockyer in the Mattsu Valley, Casey Kelly and Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, and Dan Bross in Fairbanks. APRN's Alexandra Gutierrez reported from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Josh Edge is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
The Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority has studied regional population, household, and employment statistics to forecast future traffic and revenue models for the Kinnick Arm Crossing. The authority is updating this data and commissioning an independent peer review of the work that's been completed so far. The results are expected in fall 2013. There's more information on the Kinnick Arm Bridge at kinnickarmbridge.com. This message sponsored by the Kinnick Arm Bridge and Toll Authority. Those living with asthma know that each day their life can take several different routes. So take care of yourself with daily medication and you'll be well rested and eager to take on the day. Miss taking your medication and you'll end up with restless sleep, days at home sick, or even in the emergency room. So treat your asthma even when you're feeling your best to keep you from your worst. Information at asthmainalaska.org or 1-800-LUNG-USA. This message sponsored by the American Lung Association. The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.